Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, national champions, and gunfight survivors answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Surefire, the professional's choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. And now, here's your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Surefire, the professional's choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com. Get the latest behind-the-scenes info, photos, videos, arguments, news from the field? Is it a field? The range?
I guess it could be a field.
Well, I mean
sometimes some ranges are in fields.
Sometimes. Other stuff at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Coasting with me, it's the Danger Pixie Actual, Melody Lauer.
Yeah, I'm here.
Wow, that was...
I've had some coffee this morning.
Completely unexpected and somewhat odd. So, hey, guess what?
What's that, John?
This segment brought to you by Lucky Gunner and Federal Premium Ammunition. Whether there was a firefight or you do, in fact, want to worry about that little guy, you need more ammo. And when it's time to restock, you can't beat Federal Premium Ammunition and LuckyGunner.com. With a shipping department that's always moving at 88 miles per hour, if I order a case of American Eagle from Lucky Gunner on a Thursday, it's at my doorstep ready to shoot before the weekend starts. Head to LuckyGunner.com today to check out their in-stock lineup of Federal Premium Ammunition. Remember, unless you're on fire or drowning, you can really never have too much ammo. So I am super excited because joining us for the first time in a long while is Masad Ayoub. Moss, how's it going?
Going good. Good to be with you guys. Congratulations to you both. You both shot great at the tactical conference match. And Melody, congratulations on being high female.
Oh, thank you.
Not to mention how much male booty you kicked.
Yeah. Not nearly as much as I should have, but thank you.
Well, so if we're going to talk about that, you were high lawman at the match this year, and also the only person to shoot the semifinal round clean with 100% score. I think the best I managed was a 96, 97. I can't remember, 96 or 97. So,
well, John, that may be the only time I've ever beat you shooting.
Well, you know, in fairness, I think there's been plenty of points where you could have been able to beat me shooting, and we haven't been in the same place at the same time when it's come up. You're one of the people that you're one of the people that I know. Anytime I shoot against you, you could win. Easily. It's just, and you know how it is. Whenever people get to a certain level of shooting, it's just whoever makes the first mistake, right? There was a lot of really good competition this year at the match. It's probably my favorite match that I've been to.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed the heck out of it. I told Tom Givens, our host, that I got my daily educational requirement in the classroom. I got my daily adrenaline requirement at the match, and I absolutely got my daily drama requirement watching Spencer Keeper shoot off with Gabe White.
Yeah, no,
right?
it was interesting. I'll tell you what impressed me the most out of everyone, and I don't think people really realize this, but the gentleman that took third place, Kirk Clark, he took third place with a brace on the index finger of his left hand and in an open wound on the middle finger of his left hand.
Yeah, so, that was awesome.
Yeah. So I really think had Kirk been healthy, it would have been his match. You know.
Well, he's been the winner in the past, has he not?
Yeah, the last 2 years. Kirk's a very good friend to me, and the joke is always whenever we show up in the same place, he beats me handily. But one day I will beat Kirk. That's my goal. So that's my only goal.
Playing, playing hurt is always an instructive experience. I think you've got a great podcast with Kurt right there.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's been on in the past, and hopefully going to get him on again. But I'll tell you what I want to talk about. I had the opportunity at TACCON to sit in on your unconventional wisdom lecture, and I thought it was really interesting. I kind of want to get people thinking about it a little bit more, but we got a couple minutes left in this segment before we have to go to the break. What's the general overview of that lecture?
Well, basically, Tom had asked me to talk about legal strategies for defending the justifiable shooting case.
Mm-hmm.
I've been an expert witness in that field since 1979, police prosecutor in the state of New Hampshire, since 1988 to 2017. And one of the things we found with it, it's really like defensive training itself. We're not training because we're in a dystopian world where we're going to need that training every day.
Right.
We're training for that rare aberration of the norm when it happens. And the same is true here. The criminal justice system, by and large, works very well. And most self-defense shootings are recognized as such early on, treated as such, and the person who had to do it does not go through the legal nightmare, at least in the criminal justice court.
Mm-hmm.
We do have, though, the occasional case where the righteous homicide was misunderstood, and the defender now becomes the defendant. And what we found there over the decades was that because it's so uncommon for the innocent person to be wrongfully accused, a whole lot of defense attorneys don't know how to defend them. I've talked to a great many attorneys who retired after a 20, 30-some year career and said they never felt they had ever defended a truly innocent man, that their job was to preserve the civil rights, to hold the state's feet to the fire and make sure they proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And the problem with that is that's probably the best strategy there is to defend a guilty client and minimize his convictions and sentencing. But it's not at all what you need with the genuine, innocent, wrongfully accused person who did the right thing. And that's where the unconventional wisdom element comes in, explaining why strategies that were developed and have become standard for defending the rights of the guilty accused tend to backfire and have a negative effect when they're used for the genuine, wrongly accused, innocent person.
So do you think that that's just... So I guess the number one problem, or at least the first problem in that, is the base assumption that the defending attorney is operating under as far as what successful strategies are just based off of their own experience?
Yeah, it's basically kind of the flip side of, you know, Abraham Maslow taught us all, if your only tool is a hammer, everything's going to look like a nail. I think the flip side of that is if all you ever do in your career is pound nails, you reflexively reach for the hammer, and sometimes you need a different tool.
So we got about 2.5 minutes left in this segment, but what are some of the things to maybe consider doing differently if you're a defense attorney listening to this, or if you're someone interested in the aftermath and knowing whether or not you're receiving good counsel? Where are the places to start?
Sure. Well, first, a few litmus tests when you're interviewing the attorney and the attorney selection process. If he tells you, don't worry about cross-examination, I never let my defendant take the stand,
mm-hmm.
That's the time to say, thank you for your time, how much do I owe you, I'm leaving now. Because he has just told you he has no clue how to defend an innocent person. The self-defense shooting is what's called at law an affirmative defense. We're not saying I didn't do it. We're saying, yes, I absolutely did carry out this act, but I was correct in doing so. And one of the things that happens there, you don't see it written as such in the black letter law, but anybody who's done this kind of case knows it. Essentially, it shifts the burden of proof. Normally, the burden of proof is on the accuser, the plaintiff in the civil lawsuit, the state in the criminal case. When the jury has heard your attorney say, my client shot him, they have heard a confession to a crime. And literally, that's true. The Blackwater Law doesn't say it's cool to kill dirtbags. The Blackwater Law says it's against the law to shoot people, but if you had to do it in self-defense, you should be held harmless for having done so. And essentially, we've all met the people out there in the general public, the jury pool, who think homicide and murder are synonymous. The justifiable homicide is not on their radar screen. That alone means that with real-world jury psychology, you're going to have to convince that jury that you are right to do it. It's going to come down to state of mind. Both sides stipulate you're the one who shot him. It comes down to why did you shoot him?
Well,
John, Melody, think about it. Who but you who pulled the trigger can fully articulate that?
Well, then that makes sense. We're going to pause right there because we've got to go to break, but we're talking with Masad Ayoub. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Surefire, the professional's choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. This segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s and scatterguns since 1977, a legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories, as well as the new EDC X9, which offers discriminating shooters 1911 match-grade accuracy, superior ergonomics, and concealability with modern service pistol capacity and reliability at www.wilsoncombat.com. So, we are talking with Masad Ayoub about unconventional wisdom and kind of some of the things that I guess get people in trouble after the fact is specifically with their attorneys. So the first thing that you were saying is that essentially if we need to justify, you know, why we've shot someone, the best person to do that is the person that did the shooting, right?
Exactly. What it comes down to, picture Lady Justice is holding her scales. On one side is the element of mens rea, translates literally to the guilty mind. The accuser has the burden of showing that you acted with an intent to commit a crime or a level of negligence that was so gross it met a culpable standard, that is, a guilt-producing standard. Balancing on the other side, the defense's side, is the state of mind issue. Why did you do it? The mindset of the defendant. Did you do it out of malice, evil intent, to cause harm to another you had no right to harm? Or did you do it to protect the innocent, including yourself? Shooting to protect is a valid affirmative defense. Shooting because you were in a state of rage and you wanted the other man to suffer is not. It's the essence of malice. No one can truly testify to the state of mind except the defendant or a licensed psychiatrist and psychologist if the judge, who has great discretion on this, decides to allow that testimony. There are many judges who simply distrust psychiatric testimony and will not allow it. What they cannot do is keep you, the defendant, from testifying and telling your story. And that's why I say one of the litmus tests is if your attorney says, I don't put my defendant on the stand, no one else can get that across for you. The attorney can get up at the beginning of trial and make all the promises he wants about you are in reasonable fear for your life, but he's going to have to introduce evidence in the form of testimony or hard evidence to corroborate that. And the best evidence, of course, from that is the words of the person who pulled the trigger.
Well, and let me ask you this. It seems like, too, that it's kind of important to, if you meant to shoot somebody, just say, yeah, I meant to shoot him, and not play it off as a, this wasn't, you know what I mean? This was an accident.
Because the trouble is, there is no such thing as a justifiable accident.
Right.
The most you'll find would be an excusable accident, and that's going to be pretty tough to prove. Your classic example is the hair trigger argument, which is just so misunderstood and, you know, on the internet and around the Cracker Barrel at the gun shop. The reason the hair triggers became an issue decades ago is for and there are two different motives, depending whether you're looking at the criminal system or the civil. On the criminal system, basically, the prosecutor doesn't get bonus points for convicting you of murder in the first degree instead of the second, or murder at all instead of manslaughter. It's real simple, pass-fail. Any conviction is seen as a win for the office, and they get a pat on the back.
Mm-hmm.
Any acquittal is a mark of shame for a prosecutor and a mark of incompetence. Now, to convince the jury that someone like you are Melody, you know, someone the jury is very soon going to realize is a productive member of society.
Well,
to convince them that the kind of person they see themselves as turned into Hannibal Lecter and became a murderer is a tough sell, because if you think about it, it's just one short step away from convincing them that they could turn into Hannibal Lecter.
Right.
But you've got to remember what you or I would call complete and utter BS, what you and I would call a total fabric of lies, when it's uttered by opposing counsel, is dignified in court as the plaintiff's theory of the case.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge has to treat it, and the jury has to treat it with the same seriousness, the same gravitas that they would apply to the actual truth of the case, which happens in this case to be on your side.
Well,
now, if they just come down to manslaughter, see, the key element of a murder conviction is malice, evil intent.
Right.
If they're willing to come down to manslaughter, and in many states, manslaughter will have a top penalty of 20 to 25 years, all they've got to do is convince the jury that you are careless. The key element in manslaughter is recklessness, reckless disregard for human life, negligence. And that's a whole lot easier sell, because everybody sitting on that jury at some time in their life did something stupid and made a mistake. And now it's real easy for them to believe that you did something real stupid, maybe just for a second, and made a mistake. And that's where you get in the old days, it was with the double action revolvers. It was like a cottage industry for politically motivated prosecutors and particularly greed-motivated plaintiff's lawyers. To say the officer cocked the hammer of his revolver, he created this reckless, negligent hair trigger when he should have known under stress it could go off by accident, and we maintain that it did, and that is indefensible, and that is manslaughter. Now, we sit here and say, well, no problem. I'll just tell them that I fired deliberately in self-defense. Yeah, it is a problem, because what people have to realize is if the world was taking your word for stuff, you would not be on trial. Now, any hunter safety instructor, any military instructor is going to say, no, the super light hair trigger is much more likely to discharge under stress. And all of us who teach what we teach know that this is true, that one of the things that occurs in a fight-or-flight state is vasoconstriction. Blood flow is redirected away from the extremities like the hands and into the internal organs and the major muscle groups to kind of fuel the furnace for extreme strenuous activity. And it's the real reason we all become so damn clumsy under stress. It's the reason the guy with the target trigger coming up on the plates and taking up the slack is going to get a premature shot now and then and hit below the plate before he was indexed and ready. And it's real easy to show the jury how that happens. Now, over the years, that happened so much to cops. Look at the history of it. In the late 60s, early 70s, LAPD converted all the service revolvers to double action only. The city of Miami did so after one of these false allegations resulted in a manslaughter trial against one of their officers. They rendered the service revolvers double action only. And one of the real inside secrets of why Miami became the flagship department for Glock back in the 80s was that this was all happening at the same time we had the whole cocaine cowboys thing going on in South Florida. You had the Mary Alitos and the Mariel Boatlift, et cetera. And the city of Miami cops, the union, was going to the chief and saying, for God's sake, everyone we arrest has a 14-shot 9mm. We've got six shooters from the 1890s. We need semi-automatic pistols. And the chief said publicly, well, you'll have semi-automatic pistols when they come up with one that's double action for every shot, just like your revolver is, ha, ha, ha. And then ATF says, well, this Glock, we've determined it to be double action only. And the union said, chief, well, she said, oh, crap. And that's the real story behind the scenes of how Glock got the contract. And Miami officers carry the Glocks to this day. Now, we've seen it again and again in both criminal and civil cases. And where it comes up in civil, they'll use the same argument, but for a different reason. If their argument is, you shot the guy who kicked down the door and came into your house because you were thirsty for blood, and you did it intentionally. They're looking for deep pockets, and there aren't a whole lot of us out there that if the other side gets, let's say, a $2 million verdict against us, who have $2 million liquid, unprotected, that the plaintiff's counsel can seize to satisfy the judgment. Damn near all of us have at least $1 million homeowner liability policy. If you've had to shoot the carjacker or the guy who came at you in a state of road rage, most of us have at least $1 million automobile liability insurance.
Huh.
And those insurance companies have the money.
Well, but let me interrupt there.
Here's the key thing.
If they go
into court and say you did it deliberately, they've just sewn shut the deep pockets. The reason is all those policies, if you read the fine print, will exempt the company for having to pay for a deliberate act that harmed another, what's called a willful tort. And by definition, self-defense was deliberate.
Let's hold that thought right there because we got to go to break. Right now we're talking with Masad Ayoub. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Surefire, the professional choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. This segment also brought to you by Surefire. Know your target and what is beyond it. But how can you really know your target? By shining a really bright light on it, and that's where Surefire comes in. From the new 1200-lumen EDCL2T handheld or 500-lumen EDCL1T handheld to the 1000-lumen XH35 or the soon-to-be-released 1500-lumen M600DF Scout Light, Surefire can make sure you never have to yell, Aziz, light, ever again. Surefire, the professional's choice for suppressors and illumination tools. And now, as a special offer to Ballistic Radio listeners, you can get 20% off everything at the Surefire.com web store except suppressors and batteries by entering the discount code AZIZLIGHT. That's AZIZLIGHT. No space. So anyway, we're talking with Masad Ayoub, and before the break, and this is actually really kind of interesting. And I had never really considered this, but If they're looking for essentially a payday, that's not going to happen if it's an intentional act. But if they can make it seem like it's an unintentional one, there's money attached to that for them.
If they're going for the deep pockets of the insurance company, yes.
That makes...
If it was a deliberate act and you were found wrongful, they would be going for yours. But if you don't have that much money that's going to be accessible for them to seize to satisfy the judgment, it's not worth their time to go after it. But, so basically, you're essentially keeping the blood out of the water
when
the sharks are around.
So let me ask you this, and I think this is something that's widely misunderstood in self-defense or even police shootings or stuff like that, is reaction time and human reaction time and how do people end up, you know, shot 6 or 7 times or shot in the back or, I think you know where I'm going with that, so.
Sure. And that's something that comes up a lot in both civilian and police officer shootings. I've had a couple of those just in the past couple of years, and I'm working on one now. Essentially what happens, you've got to understand the intersection between the OODA loop, the observe, orient, decide, act, reaction paradigm of both the shooter and the suspect. The suspect is coming at you, let's say, with a knife. Okay, you come up with your gun, and you know this guy's close enough. I've got to fire as fast as I can until he goes down, and you're pulling the trigger as fast as you can. For most of us, that's going to be 4 to 5 shots per second. For a Jerry Michalak, it's going to be 8 shots per second.
Right.
Now, he sees the gun coming up and reflexively starts to turn away. This was totally unanticipated by you. Let's face it, if you thought he was going to turn away, you wouldn't have started shooting at him at all.
Right.
So you're firing as fast as you can. you now have to process. You have to observe his turning away from you. You have to orient what it means. Gee, it means he's no longer attacking me. You have to decide, what do I do? Gee, I think I better decide to stop shooting. And finally, act. The first physical phase of Colonel Boyd's OODA loop is you've got to get the finger off the trigger and make it stop shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, typical reaction time, we all know, is about a quarter second. But what we have to factor in and explain to the juries is all those tests are reaction to anticipated stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
You knew in the moment there was going to be the beep from the timer that would tell you to slap the speaker and register the time. Here we have the exact opposite. We have unanticipated stimulus. We have that whole cognitive process that we have to realize what's going on. And that takes at least three times longer, often more.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, X number of shots have been fired as the other man is unexpectedly turning into the trajectory of the bullet. And we're able to show, it takes probably 10 to 20 minutes to do it in court, we're able to show that at that point it is physically impossible for you to stop shooting the trigger, pulling the trigger before at least one shot has struck behind the lateral midline of the opponent.
Mm-hmm.
And when you explain that, the light bulb goes on. The problem is the general public in almost every culture has been taught from childhood to believe anyone who was shot in the back was a victim of murder, that any attacker would be coming at you, so if the wounds are not in the front, it could not possibly be self-defense. And it's something really that it's certainly not taught in law school, and it's something that the defense is going to have to get across. But the key to that is you need an attorney who knows that it does have to be gotten across. There's going to have to be demonstrative evidence. And the way we generally do it, we will do something on video showing clearly how it happens with a counter going on the screen, and we can demonstrate it in the courtroom, acting it out in front of the jury. Now, interesting thing with that, judges have great latitude, of course, on what evidence they will and will not allow. I've seen, and this is why you want to be able to have both of those elements ready, the in-court live demonstration and a video. X number of judges will say, look, nobody's going to get up and do a little dance in front of the jury in my courtroom. This is not Shakespeare in the Park. Counselor, if you want to show the jury something, put it on video, and we'll show it on our audiovisual to them.
Right.
You will also find judges who will say, look, I know what you people can do with CGI. I do not trust this technology. If you want to show something in court that involves human beings, counselor, you put a couple of live human beings right here in front of the jury box and show them. So I've seen judges go both ways on that. I have never seen a judge keep out both.
Huh.
And that's why you want to have both right there, depending on the whim of the guy or gal who is running the courtroom.
Well, and it seems like that's kind of one of those things where maybe you have a little bit of an idea ahead of time what you're getting as far as the judge goes, but you never are quite certain what they're going to say, do, or allow.
Exactly. And particularly we've seen in the world of expert testimony and everything from medicine to science to psychiatry to this, there are so many prostitute experts out there who will say whatever they're being paid to say that a great many judges are leery of expert testimony.
Right.
So that's why for demonstrative evidence, I want to have both video and live capability right there, depending what the judge rules in the motion in limine. The motions in limine are the pretrial motions that are one side argues to the judge, I want this evidence in, the other side says, I don't. And the balance is probative value versus prejudicial potential. Probative value means will it help the jury to find the actual salient facts that are important to this case. The prejudicial element is, Your Honor, they're simply trying to inflame the passions of the jury against my client with all their drama, and this has nothing to do with reality. And the judges, again, have great, great latitude on that. And usually they're done pre-trial. Sometimes the judge will say, I'm going to let the trial develop, and then when the time comes and you want to introduce this evidence, I'll give the jury a break, and we'll have the hearing here in the courtroom, and I'll decide then and there what I'm going to allow. And this is why because you don't know what his decision is going to be, you want to have both elements ready to present if necessary.
Well, we've got about 2 minutes left in the segment, so I'm curious where I want to go with this to where I won't have to interrupt you midstream. let me ask you this, real quick. What's the most surprising thing you've ever seen a judge do? If there is a real quick of that, and then we'll get to the next segment.
Well, I've frequently and recently in the last couple of years seen judges keep out the defendant's own statements that the state that had been made to the police because they were too favorable to the defense, and the judge ruled that they were self-serving. And this, I don't know if it's a new trend or maybe it was going on all along and I just missed it, but it is absolutely appalling. Here are the statements that the defendant made to the investigating officer that the prosecution itself said was determinative enough of guilt that it was part of the decision to prosecute, and yet they do not want the jury to see it. And amazingly, in at least two recent cases, the judges have kept that up.
Huh. That's
interesting.
Yeah, that strikes me as very odd, but I don't know.
Really as odd as it struck me.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, kudos to you, sir, for being able to keep your composure when things like that happen instead of standing up and going, what? But we got to go to break. Right now we're talking with Masad Ayoub. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back. Ballistic Radio brought to you by Surefire, the professional's choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. So we're talking with Masad Ayoub about all sorts of interesting things in regards to self-defense after the trial portion of self-defense and how you defend yourself in the courtroom and interesting factoids about that. So before the break, I asked you what the weirdest thing you'd seen a judge do, and you were telling me about them keeping out defendants' own statements given to police or investigators because they were too favorable to the defendant, which just strikes me as odd, but what do I know?
Struck me as odd too, my brother.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess... here's a question that somebody asked me to ask you the next time I spoke with you. So, and I've got you on the show, so I'm curious. What are your thoughts on private citizens under the watchful eye of an instructor shooting like a federal or state qualification and having that score recorded and kept on record by the instructor? I know that's something that Melody and I do. I know that's something that Tom Givens has done at several classes of his that I've been at and that other instructors do. But do you think there's value there, or is that just
there
kind
is.
Of... Okay.
I think there is, and in our classes, we have them shoot a police-type qualification for the record also. And the reason is during the voir dire, the jury selection process, opposing counsel is going to screen out the gun buffs, the gun enthusiasts, the people who've been in situations like this as being too favorable to one side. If your attorney is worth the tuition that put him or her through law school, they will screen out members of, you know, the Gabby Giffords group, militant anti-gunners, etc. So in a best of all worlds, you'll have 12 people and two or three alternates who, they don't feel one way or the other about guns. If the issue comes down to were you reckless, were you incompetent, et cetera, the general public, rightly or wrongly, equates the law enforcement standard as essentially the gold standard for someone who's competent to walk around in this society carrying a loaded gun. If the other side implies, well, this person got a concealed carry permit, they thought it made them a super cop or something, and blah, 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 they weren't competent to carry a gun like a policeman. I would love for your attorney to be able to say, excuse me, my client has passed the same qualification course as a trooper in this state. Chris Serino and Michelle Serino, who work with John Benner in Ohio on the FASTER program, training the armed school faculty,
yeah.
they made a point of taking the Ohio State Patrol qualification and requiring their students to pass it 5% higher score than state troopers, simply so they could say to those who questioned it, our people can literally run this gun better than the state troopers that you're going to call when you're in trouble.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I think I see benefit to that.
Well, and it seems like
assuming,
one of, the,
of course, one can pass the qualification.
Well, yeah, there's that. But then, you know, and honestly, too, I think something that is overlooked oftentimes by instructors and specifically students is there's value in not, you know, if you're not able to pass a qualification, knowing where the wheels come off so that you're not taking shots that you're not reasonably certain that you are able to make.
Sure. Now, when Tom or I give you a police qualification, it's going to be at the end of a course where we've taught you how to shoot well if you didn't know already.
Yeah.
For the average person, find out what that course of fire is, get out there and practice it, make sure you can pass it on demand, and then go ahead and take it in front of a qualified instructor, or for that matter, on videotape yourself.
Yeah.
Or on your iPhone camera and archive the video.
Well, let me ask you this, and this is kind of something that I am very curious about whenever I speak with anyone that's been doing this quite a long time. And I asked Tom when he was on the show, so I'll ask you as well. Is there anything over the course of 30, 40 years that you've changed your mind on, that you felt very strongly about maybe a year ago, maybe 20 years ago, that now, in with the benefit of further reflection or hindsight, that you've changed your position on?
Well, sure, a lot of things. When I came into it, the heavy hitters were teaching double taps for everything, and then lower the gun to assess. And that turned out not to work terribly well on the street, because if the double tap has now taken an immediate effect and you have lowered your weapon, the other guy does not see this as a timeout on both sides. And if he has not been incapacitated, basically, the next thing you're going to see is a bright orange flash, and then everything's going to go dark forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when most of us went to, you are going to assess while you're shooting, and if the first few rounds haven't worked, you're going to pick a different point of aim on the body and go to plan B. And that seems to have worked a great deal better.
Anything else jump out at you as far as?
On the mechanical side, in the early days, I wrote an article in like 1972 with, you know, again, conventional wisdom. It was what I had always been taught. I think my exact words were, when you take your Browning High Power or your Smith & Wesson 9mm apart, reassemble it without the magazine disconnector. Take the disconnector down to the jewelry store, see if they can make a tie clip out of it, and that way it will perform a useful function. And over the years, I had to change my mind on that. I saw so many cases, usually in struggles for the gun.
Yep.
When the other guy is he's gaining control, he's getting the gun away, and the good guy realizes he's going to get the gun. They intentionally pressed the mag release button and essentially had pressed a kill switch on the gun. And when the guy got it away from him and pulled the trigger, they were unable to do so. So I certainly had to change my position on that.
When it seems like something, too, that, you know, for me personally, and I can only speak for me, but oftentimes whenever I've encountered something that, you know, I felt strongly about and then later I revisit it, it's just I personally was not as good at viewing the big picture as I thought I was in the moment of making those decisions or making those opinion calls, I guess. Let me ask you this. What are you excited about right now? Is there anything new or anything that you're looking forward to, or you've been doing this a very long time, so I'm curious what blows your skirt up these days, for lack of a better term.
Well, on the shooting side of it, last year, the old second chance match, the bowling pin match, I shot that thing for 24 consecutive years. It was my annual vacation. And for those who haven't been to one, picture a carnival midway with all, instead of winning a teddy bear, you win a gun if you do well. And lots of different games to play, and it lasts 7 or 8 days, and you're there with hundreds of people who have the same values you do. Mm-hmm. It was the best way I could put it, if shooting matches were rock concerts, Second Chance was Woodstock. Now, there was about a 19-year layoff, and last year they started up again. Second Chance Company is no longer the sponsor. It's now sponsored by Armor Express in Central Lake, Michigan, and it's called simply The Pin Shoot. Go to pinshoot.com. It is the most fun you can have with a gun in your hand. And I went last year, loved it. It was like going back to a 20-year high school reunion or something. And I'm definitely going back this year. It'll be in June in a beautiful lake area, resort area in Michigan.
Well, that sounds like fun. They've
got rifle, they've got shotgun, they've got revolver and auto, they've got everything.
No, that does sound like fun. I'm personally looking forward to hopefully getting to come and take a Mag 40 class with you sometime soon. We're looking at May, possibly. We've got to work out some details still, but...
Gail Pepin and I are looking forward to taking the armed parent, or in our case, armed grandparent, course with you two. We've been hearing great things about it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Hopefully we can cross-pollinate.
Yeah. I'm very curious to... very curious to get your thoughts on it, and that's something that I, you know, Melody and I have both tried very hard to do is get as many qualified instructors out to the class as we can, just so that it's peer reviewed, because I don't think there's enough of that, especially in the younger generation of instructors. You know, it's like nobody's got any secret sauce that we can't show. It's just like, no, I don't do that.
But. And when I talk about your books, I want to make sure that I'm not misquoting you.
Yeah, right. So if people want to come train with you, we're at the end of the show. If people want to come train with you, take a class with you, where can they find out more information?
Sure. Our website is the best bet. We have courses all over the country. It's massadayoubgroup.com. That's massadayoubgroup.com. For the books, the easiest thing is to go on Amazon. There's 20 or 21 of them out there now. Take a quick look, read the reviews, see what appeals to what you're looking for, and good luck.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Moss. I'm sorry that it's been 4 years since we've had you on. We will try to accelerate the schedule next time. It's always a pleasure, sir.
Well, it's always a pleasure with you guys. We listen to your podcast regularly, and we've learned a lot from it.
Well, thank you very much. I hope you have a good day. Give my best to Gail, and I'll talk to you soon.
I will, and my best to all your listeners.
All right, thank you very much. So make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. And hey, keep leaving those 5-star review on iTunes. We really appreciate it. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe. See you next week.